Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. As always, some housekeeping and announcements before we get started. Most importantly, to me at least, is to remind you that my love letter to the Enchantment of the Year, A Witch's Book of Days, is available to pre-order wherever you buy books. It's out September 8th, 2026. Pre-orders are vital to a book's success, so if you think you might want your own copy, I would be ever so grateful if you hit up your favorite bookseller now. Here's an early review to give you a taste of what A Witch's Book of Days is. It's an uncommon gift to encounter a book teeming with annual rhythmic magic the way A Witch's Book of Days does. Part spellbook, part history lesson, part recipe collection, and a total love letter to the changing tides of the year. Victoria transforms our calendar, our wheel of the year, entirely. Via Hedera, author of Folkloric American Witchcraft. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, an independent, family-owned, digital and print-on-demand publisher of books we want to see in the world. If you'd like to support Witchlit and a Thousand Volt Press, the best way to do that is buy our books. Our most recent title is The Keeper and the Mermaid, a debut contemporary fantasy novella by Kathy Lynn. Other titles include Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and Pagan Roots by Yvonne A. Burrow. And my most recent novel, Verona Green, A Story of Art and Magic. Head over to thousandvoltpress.com/store or order them wherever you buy books. All those links can be found in the show notes. Listening, subscribing, and leaving a rating or review also supports the podcast, and we really appreciate it, so thank you. Next month, I'll be joined by Tracy Norman, folklore author and playwright. We'll be discussing Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber and other stories published in 1979. It's pretty widely available as an inexpensive ebook, $2.99 on Apple Books. And there is a much pricier audio version available to purchase. And Libro at least had the Angela Carter BBC Radio Drama Collection, which includes radio plays of some of the stories if you can't find the more expensive audiobook. You know the drill. Before we jump into this month's episode, I'm going to give you some background on the book and author we'll be discussing before I introduce this month's guest. And just in case, I wanted to let you know that the book we're discussing is pretty frank about sex. If you listen to Witchlit with young kiddos or anyone of delicate sensibilities, or if you listen to it out loud at work, and seriously let me know if you do that, you might want to skip this episode or listen to it later. We're going to try and keep it pretty clean, but just in case. So first, I want to tell you about Larry Mitchell, who's the author of this book. He was born in Muncie, Indiana on July 12, 1939, which he described as a nightmare. He died on December 26, 2012 in Ithaca, New York, after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He lived with his partner, Rick Morrison. He is the author of many works of fiction that explored queer life and radical politics in New York City's Lower East Side and East Village in the 1980s and 90s. Mitchell founded Calamus Press, an early small press devoted to gay literature, and with Felice Picano and Terry Helbing, and I apologize if I didn't pronounce their names correctly, co-founded Gay Presses of New York in 1981. Mitchell received a PhD in sociology from Columbia University and was a professor at the College of Staten Island for 25 years. In addition to the book we're discussing that has what is considered a slur in the title, which I will use when referring to the title, The Faggots and Their Friends Between Revolutions, 1977, his novels include The Terminal Bar, 1982, In Heat, 1986, My Life as a Mole, and Five Other Stories, 1988. Which won a Lambda Literary Award, and Acid Snow, 1993, which was actually adapted into a film. He helped form multiple communes, including one on Staten Island, which collectively wrote The Great Gay in the Morning, One Group's Approach to Communal Living and Sexual Politics, published in 1972 by Times Change Press, and one outside of Ithaca, New York, called Lavender Hill, which is a subject of a 2013 documentary by Austin Bunn. I don't usually read the illustrators bio, but this book is heavily illustrated, and I think he and the illustrator worked kind of in tangent with it. So I want to talk a little bit about the illustrator, who is Ned Asta, who was born in New York in Brooklyn, and was a member of and has been a member of the Moosewood Collective in Ithaca, New York, since 1980, and was a founding member of the Lavender Hill Commune with Mitchell. Asta was a member of the New York queer theater troupe Hot Peaches in the late 1970s and later co-founded the Breast Cancer Alliance in Ithaca with Amy Gladstone. So that's a little bit about the authors and the author and the illustrator. And then I want to read you a little bit about the book. And this is from Wikipedia. So Mitchell was inspired to write The Faggot and Their Friends Between Revolutions following a trip to the Castro in San Francisco in the early 1970s. He based it in part on his experience living in Lavender Hill, a queer commune in Ithaca, New York, that Mitchell and Asta were founding members of. Mitchell conceived of the book in reaction to a lack of contemporary gay literature. He initially planned for The Faggots and Their Friends Between Revolutions to be a children's picture book illustrated by Asta, but it would ultimately become a novel of prose and illustrations. Years after its release, the book proliferated through unofficial photocopied and later PDF reproductions and developed a cult following. Reviewing the 2019 reissue for Slate, critic John Russell comments on the story's contemporary relevance, noting that the descriptions of Ramrod's disintegration and the men's hostility toward the faggots and their friends, quotations, are echoed in Trump's America. Regarding the novel's utopian philosophy, Russell writes that he is of two minds and expresses discomfort over what seems to me like Mitchell's ultimate strategy of divestment from the world of men, which we'll talk about. So, and to talk about this magical protean cult classic with me is my guest this month, MK Zariel. MK uses it and its and other masculine pronouns and is a transmasculine neuroqueer poet, theater artist, movement journalist, and bashback aligned anarchist. The author of Void Gazing 2026 and is fueled by folk punk, Emma Goldman, and existential dread. It can be found online at mkzgillcard, that's carrd.co, creating conflictually queer anarchic spaces, and writing columns for Asymptote and the Anarchist Review of Books, and being mildly feral in the Great Lakes region. MK, welcome to Witchlit.
Hello, thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
I am so excited to talk to you about this book. I had kind of heard of it just in the zeitgeist, but I had never read it. So it was really a fun excuse to track it down, which I have to say is a little more difficult, I think, than it used to be. I think it's a little harder to find those PDFs. I did order it from AK Press. So if anybody's looking for it, that is an option. But the first thing I ask everybody on the show and what I cannot wait to hear from you about is, why did you choose this book for us to talk about?
So I recently had the honor of publishing a few poetry collections, Boy Apparition, Different With Him, and Void Gazing. And all of them are kind of circling this question of, what does masculinity look like and what does butchness look like when it has nothing to do with cis womanhood or cis manhood? What does it look like to be transmasculine without wanting to pass? What does it look like to be butch without wanting to be a cis lesbian or even buy into that kind of turfy ideology that says you have to be a woman to be lesbian, etc.? And what does it look like to create a butch and queer masculinity that is divested from patriarchy, that gets to be androgynous, that doesn't need to be solely masculine all the time, etc.? And rather than simply processing these questions, you know, in therapy or however normal people handle their gender dysphoria, I elected to write three poetry collections about it. And when I decided to come on this podcast and got the prompt of choosing a book that kind of had some connection to pagan spirituality or mysticism or magic or all the rest, I, of course, reached for this kind of speculative prophetic fiction text that is entirely about queer masculinity and maleness as completely different societal roles and what that means. And while reading it, even though I'm not a gay man, I'm a non-binary transmasculine lesbian, I found so much of it so resonant about what it is to create queer and transmasculinities outside of the binary.
Yeah, that's awesome. So do you think reading this book also influenced your poetry, or are those kind of separate spheres for you?
I would say my involvement in and fascination with the queer bashback tendency did influence my poetry. So not just this particular work, but the entire body of work around queer liberationism and anarchism and egoism and all those other strands of thought. So not just this, but Jean Genet and the Mary Nardini gang and every other queer and trans author or collective that's in that kind of mode of thinking.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I hadn't read it. And I think one of the things in reading the book was both this feeling of kind of sadness for like a world that could be, I guess, and also sadness and anger about the world that is, which I think was interesting with that, with Russell's critique of the book of the new edition, and just like how, you know, as subcultures isn't even the right word, just as identities, how we create safe spaces in the ruin just really resonated with me right now.
Yeah, I feel that. And a lot of what I'm processing in my poetry, too, is what it means to create anarchist movements in a time when they are so desperately needed, where, you know, we're living in a society that is increasingly moving in the direction of fascism. And so the project of anarchism doesn't just feel like this imagining of a queer and trans future. It also feels like this kind of desperate effort to create a bulwark between us and fascism. Mm-hmm. And so there can be more stress and there can be more anarchist infighting. You know, anyone who has read Boy Apparition will know that there's an entire poem in there about people not being able to get along at events.
Yes.
And all of this is addressed in Larry Mitchell's text, but in a slightly less teenage angst way and a slightly more speculative fiction way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think, I mean, in reading the book and then reading Boy Apparition, like kind of as a combo was interesting because I could see like some resonance there in that. And like I do, I think part of like the part of the book that I really enjoyed is that, yes, he does talk about, or Mitchell does talk about, you know, this kind of the kind of infighting, but there's also so much care amongst these different groups of the women, or the, you know, the gay women, the lesbians, the just the women that they learn from, all of the different kind of identities under the umbrella of the friends part of the title. And it was like, I have seen that occasionally, but like you said, sometimes there, you know, it unfortunately becomes this circular firing squad of like, whose fault is this, or we have to do it this way, or there's no point kind of thing. So I think part of the speculative fiction and part of the fantasy is this idea that there's much less of that than there seems to be in reality sometimes.
Yes, exactly. Like, queer and trans infighting is a thing that happens. And at the same time, as a queer person, I've witnessed so much solidarity between people with different identities. Like, I consider myself a transmasculine lesbian, meaning that I don't want to pass as a man, I want to present butch, and I also don't feel like a cis woman. And I've experienced so much solidarity from binary trans men, from cis lesbians, from people who might be somewhere else on the non-binary spectrum. And, you know, I think that if you just scroll Tumblr, you get the sense that people with different queer and trans identities or labels fight with each other constantly about it. Like, there are all these posts in which transmasculine people are critical of transfeminine people or vice versa. But in our anarchist movements, it feels like the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do think there is, it is interesting to me how much, like, this book was written in the 70s and how timely it feels right now. But I think that, you know, as the pressure, like, you know, pre-Stonewall, when a lot of what he is talking about in the book happens, and now under the pressure of our current regime, like, it feels like the infighting seems more futile and useless, and maybe happens a little less when we're under pressure in a different way. Again, I don't feel like I get to make giant pronouncements about that, but that's the feeling, I guess. So,
I mean, as always, two things can be true. I think that some people respond to fascism by feeling even more insular and wanting just their affinity group with the four or five people who they know and trust, which mm-hmm. is valid.
Yeah.
And some people, like me, respond to fascism by wanting to join five different projects and be friends with like a couple hundred different people and, you know, learn so much more about new identities and communities and build community trans locally and do all the things.
Yeah.
And to an extent, both of those responses are healthy ways to handle it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I believe that to articulate a queer anarchism and to create a queer and trans future, we must engage with people who identify differently than we do. We cannot constantly debate about whether he, him, lesbians are valid, or whether fluidity is valid, or whether someone who's trans and straight can still be in queer spaces, or all these things that get debated but have obvious answers if you're just engaging with other human beings with the intention to build community. Because people can identify and behave however they want.
Right.
And if it pleases them, there really isn't a problem with it. Like, the other day, I was freaking out to a friend over whether I actually was trans. And we got to the conclusion that if you feel better being trans, you should be, regardless of whether you feel dysphoria or anything else.
Yeah.
And I would like to see more of that attitude in our contemporary queer spaces. And I think that in Mitchell's book and in the world I'm hoping to create with my poetry, that exists.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's the interesting thing you touched on, because I think there is this, the thing that I feel in Mitchell's work, and not just this book, but in some of his other stuff, because I've read Terminal Bar and a couple other things, but that, you know, that I still think there is a belief, and I believe that even now in the face of, you know, the poly crisis we're in, is that that art actually matters, and that, you know, these I interviewed Margaret Killjoy for the podcast a couple years ago, and one of the things she said was talking about like a song or a poem or a book, that these are spells we put out in the world, right? These are actions that are an attempt to create, like you said, the world we want. And so I think, you know, reading this book now and reading your work and thinking about my own work in context of that, just like how important that is to continue, even when I think there are a lot of days, you know, even as a writer, I feel like, can this possibly matter right now with everything else going on? But it does matter.
Yeah, I mean, to paraphrase a random folk punk lyric, a poem won't ever change the world, but I can tell you about some that changed me. Like, I don't think that poetry alone will bring about a potential anarchist future. I don't think that's possible, because anarchism relies on all kinds of strengths. We need people's material needs to be met. We need networks of emotional support. We need people who really want to engage in direct action. And we need poets and writers. And obviously there's overlap. I know many a poet who is also engaged in mutual aid work. But I really respond to this question of whether creative labor is actually relevant to our movements. And I think about how in Mitchell's text, there's a lot of talk about domestic labor, about how a lot of the time it is queer and trans people who are doing both artistic work and care work, and how this is what actually sustains our societies and gives people reasons to keep going, more so than the kind of hyper-masculine, hierarchical, and usually statist labor that we prioritize as a society tends to. So obviously, some people do see anarchism solely as an artistic subculture. There are people who conflate anarchism and punk, for example. And I don't think that's awesome. I think there's so much more to anarchism than the creative arts. But at the same time, anarchism absolutely relies on the creative arts. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think you're right. I think there is a conflation between like a subculture idea and anarchism for a lot of people. And I think there's also some really deep misunderstandings of what anarchism is as a political movement. I think some people have some weird ideas about that. And personally, I fall kind of somewhere in that gray liminal space between socialism and anarchy. Like, I'm not sure I have a label that fits perfectly, but it's always interesting to me when you see artwork in whatever format that tries to speak both as art and politically. And I think most art does that. Sometimes it's purposeful and sometimes it's not. But like, I'm always interested in how it's almost like anarchy, like you said, is considered an artistic movement in a way that's weird to me. And I've never quite grasped why that is. It's like no one really considers capitalism an artistic movement. You know, like it's an interesting dichotomy. But yeah,
I mean, in a sense, I think part of that assumption is because art and culture are the ideal vehicles for anarchism in a way that might not be true of other social movements. Like, I love Emma Goldman's essay, The Social Significance of the Modern Drama, which essentially makes the argument that theater is the best way to spread anarchist beliefs because it's happening right in front of you and is responsive to the audience. And so it's a lot harder to ignore or dismiss than, say, a piece of visual art, which is relatively static and doesn't really respond to the people engaging with it. Mm-hmm. And while I'm not sure I agree that theater is like the best cultural vehicle for anarchism, I would make a plug for, you know, performance poetry or whatever. But that's because I'm a little biased there. I do think that we don't really see democratic socialist art. We don't really see centrist art, but we see quite a lot of anarchist art. Mm-hmm. And that's because anarchism is obviously an ideology that allows for quite a lot of creativity. Like, if you're someone who cares about, you know, building community more than sustaining hierarchy, then part of that will be helping people engage with the creative arts. And partially because anarchism doesn't really have access to the typical tools that a political movement would use to spread. Like, typically, anarchism does not function through the electoral system. Some of us may vote as harm reduction, some of us may not, but regardless, it's not our focus. And so we need other ways to communicate about politics that aren't just organizing and direct action.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I think, I don't know, like, I read this book over a couple days, because for anyone who hasn't read it, it's actually a pretty quick read. But, it's one of those things that kind of sits with you and you carry it around when you're reading it. And even since I finished it, I've carried it around a lot, this idea, just, and it comes up in different images throughout the book, of kind of this ruined city that is, you know, the decaying, he calls it Ramrod in the book, this decaying empire of Ramrod, the empire of the men, and that, you know, the queer people and the women and, you know, all of these people who are outside of that privilege, quotation marks, of ruling, find these places and basically make nests, you know, almost within the city. And I think about how, like, that, I don't know, it speaks to me of mutual aid, and it speaks to me of the communities that we create, you know, even in online spaces, which is, you know, all some people have access to. But it was just this idea of, you know, joy amid the rubble, almost, in a way, even dealing with the violence and all of that stuff, which he doesn't gloss in the book. I mean, there's lots of mentions of, you know, involvement with the law and being, you know, and having to deal with the violence of this over culture. But I do really like it. It was so nice to carry around this idea of creating these pockets of safety and joy in the midst of this.
Exactly. I love the quote from the Situationist International about the necessity of creating a new world in the shell of the old. Mm-hmm. And I think it really speaks to how anarchist societies do not drop from the sky. They don't form cleanly. They don't just decide on a group chat to do anarchism and then do that without any problems. They're made from, you know, usually people who have dealt with capitalism and the state and experienced the trauma of that. And, you know, obviously, like our lived experiences vary in the anarchist community, but there is no untraumatized person under capitalism. And there is especially no untraumatized queer person under capitalism. And so this idea of building community in the ruins of building belonging and care out of what we're given, which, you know, might not be universally positive, like we might have a history of state power to contend with that we've experienced throughout our lives. I think that's really powerful, and that's something I try to integrate into my poetry quite a lot. Like my recent book, Void Gazing, which came out about a month ago as of this recording on Whittle Micro Press, is about gender and technology, but more so it's about what it means to build online space as queer and trans people. And this is in a world where the internet can be a crazy place. Like, many of us have been cyberbullied. Many of us have been doxxed. Many of us have been trolled on the internet or worse. And then there's the risk of corporate and state surveillance in those spaces. So the internet is not neutral. It's been incredibly traumatic for a lot of people. And even if it hasn't, the reality of capitalism and the state encroaching on our digital spaces is not, you know, an unstressful one. So creating online space is, as you say, quite a lot like creating community in a physical space that's been ruined or damaged. And, you know, choosing to build networks of care and belonging and community and abundance and all of it, even if the spaces we're in have a history that is not necessarily a positive one.
Yeah. Well, and I think about there's so many parallels between reading this book now and our lived reality now that, I think about how atomized everyone kind of became because of COVID. Like we kind of all had to go home and be apart. And so online spaces became sometimes the only way we could connect with other people. And I had the experience of moving cross country during the middle of the pandemic. And basically, when everyone came back outdoors, I was in a place where I didn't know anybody, so so online stuff became really important to me. And but then also came all of the I think the noise of being too online in a way, because because of the algorithms, because of what social media has been turned into to sell us ideas about things. I just made the decision to walk away from that, which was pretty isolating, turns out, in a way. It's kind of interesting. But I still think that there, like you said, there's still space in that to be positive. But I do think it points up how important, in real life, meeting people is and being involved in things in a local way, even though that can be hard depending on where you are in your life. And I mean, as an adult, I find it difficult to make friends, more difficult than when I was younger, and you just spent more time with people by default, either because of school or because of your job or because of just the cohort of your age being more, having more spaces to do that that didn't involve alcohol or don't involve, certain things. So I think it's interesting to think about, and maybe that's why it resonated so much in me and why it's really made me think about, what have I built? What is there to build? What are we building? What is there to build? And how to, I don't know, in a really soft way, kind of feather our nests better than what we are doing right now. So.
Exactly. And you're so right about the lack of mixed age spaces and age accessible spaces. And this can be true on both ends of the age spectrum, too. Like, as a younger anarchist, as someone who became an anarchist when I was 14, I've had brushes with ageism in organizing spaces. I've had to deal with the fact that a lot of events are 18 plus or 21 plus. But I also think that the anarchist movement does intergenerationally really well. Like, thanks to my anarchism, my youngest friend is 12 and my oldest friend is 80. And from there, it's kind of a bell curve. Like, I have never been the kind of teenager who only has friends who are teenagers. And I find that attitude and lifestyle a little bit limiting, although Of course, friendships are personal, and I don't think that everyone needs to have mixed age friendships. I just think that a healthy society is one where that's an option within, obviously, with plenty of communication and awareness around boundaries, as there always need to be when any power dynamic is possible. And on the question of online space, I think you're really right that contending with digitized capitalism on social media can become really overwhelming and can feel almost like physical noise, but also not engaging with it is rather isolating too. At the same time, I think if we were to tell the queer and trans people of 200 years ago that there would be a technology that would allow them to connect with queer and trans people in any city in the entire world, then they'd be thrilled, and they'd want to use it to organize and build community and, you know, break the social isolation of being queer and trans that existed in those times and still in many ways does. I don't think there's anything inherently harmful about the use of technology, but I think there is a lot harmful about the culture that's sprung up in certain online spaces that we get to rewrite or opt out of or, you know, engage with in limited ways.
No, I agree.
But the entire text of void gazing is essentially these vignettes about moving through online space as a queer person, some positive, some aggressively not, some about being trolled, some about finding who you really are online, some about building community. And I'm doing that to show that online space can be anything we make it, but it's also already a lot of things that we didn't choose and have to figure out how to contend with as a queer community.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I think probably the healthiest attitude to have about it. But, I, you know, one of the things I think is beautiful about the advent of the internet, like you said, this way to like not feel so alone, but also like I feel like it has made it easier. Like, I mean, I was in college during like the first zine explosion. Like that was, you know, the 90s Riot Girl days and all that. And so I love this, like re-exploring this whole topic of zines and all of that. But I think, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about the internet is like before, like you might get your zine out to, you know, if you were lucky, like 100 people, like at a show or at something. And now like you can put your zine in a PDF and it can go all over the world. So like this idea of being able to share ideas, you know, the books we write, the poems we write, the songs we sing, the zines we make, to be able to share these things in a bigger way is pretty amazing. And it's put the tools to make that happen in the hands of people who never had access to that. So I think that part of it is always going to be exciting to me, even with the downsides, maybe.
Yes, exactly. Like someone I know once said to me that he thought the internet made anarchism both necessary and possible. And that's kind of where I've landed with it too. And what I was kind of thinking about when I wrote Void Gazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
like an internet without anarchism is a fragmented and isolating one that focuses on the least marginalized voices. And an anarchism without the internet might become hyper-local and isolate people who truly don't have an anarchist community or queer community where they are.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, even people I know who would not consider themselves anarchists or particularly far left still fight against this idea of making the internet, you know, all of the things that have tried to come to pass to make the internet belong more to our corporate overlords. Like I long for the chaotic early internet when you just had to find stuff in some ways, though I do love
it. Yes, exactly.
But, yeah.
And like, I will be the last person to moralize AI. Obviously there are people who use AI as a disability aid and I'm not, and all of that. However, I think the proliferation of AI slop on the internet does nothing to help because, you know, it's closer to fascist art, if that's even a thing, than anything ever could be, because it's dry, it's extractive, it doesn't actually platform or support a human artist. And that means that fascist projects, such as we're seeing with the current administration and their constant use of AI-generated content, now have the ability to mimic what human artists are doing. And, you know, financial stability is a lot less possible for people who are doing art and writing.
Yeah, I mean,
and, you know, as a poet, I don't feel threatened. Like, I did ask ChatGPT to write a poem in my style, and the premise of the poem just amounted to, I'm gay and that's sad. Like, there was no emotional depth there.
Oh, yeah.
It was longer than that, but, you know, that was the main point.
Yeah.
However, I still think this question of how can we make the internet an actually liberatory space, or if that's even possible, or, you know, how we can build community online while being decent to each other and, you know, and not reflexively getting into social hierarchy because that's what people already are doing, is a necessary one to talk through.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's most of what void gazing is about. And rereading the Larry Mitchell book in preparation for this, there are certainly themes in there that we could apply to our digital spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Like the idea that dreaming toward an anarchist future is possible and necessary even as repression escalates. Yeah, the critique of assimilationism. We see so much assimilationism in our queer spaces online. It's deeply alarming. And all the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that is true. And it's interesting to me, like, even thinking about, like, that concept, like, you know, that when this book was out of print, like, people would pass around photocopies or mimeographs or whatever of it, right? And then as the internet came into being, then it got passed around as PDFs. And so it's almost like, I don't know, it's almost like this recursive idea of, like, the art imitating itself kind of thing of, you know, this book written by someone who was writing in a time before access to these kind of things, like, that book then also becomes part of this future that I don't even know that he even really imagines in the book. Like, I don't, like, there's, you know, what is it? The future is now, it's just unevenly distributed. Like, I think about that a lot about, just how, like, whatever art I'm creating now, like, whatever, you know, the books I write, you know, that this podcast, you know, anything that I put out in the world, like, I have no clue what that's going to mean to anyone when it leaves my hands, but I definitely have no idea what that is going to mean to anyone 50 years from now or 100 years from now, if it still exists, you know, like, so I think it's interesting to think about, like, the, and kind of, like, it was interesting to me to think, to have that thought while reading this book that was written in 79. It's almost as old as me. And and reading your poetry that was written this year, you know, like, it's very interesting to read those two things together and think about, like, the echoes and how things have changed and how, like, even looking at the title of this book, like, I don't know that he could have even in his own press printed this book and people would have carried it in the same way. Like, I mean, it's difficult to find. It was difficult to find even the reprint. So I think it's interesting. Like, when we think about, like, what, I think I'm probably talking in circle here, but, like, what does this mean? And what can, even in our dreaming, what can we not even possibly imagine, you know, like, what the future could be like? Like you said, you know, 200 years ago, a trans or queer person would have had no concept of the internet. And what would that have meant to them? Kind of thing.
I mean, in my own writing, one thing I talk about is that many of us can't possibly dream of what masculinity might look like if manhood is taken out of the equation. And that's why I argue that we should look to the historical book's role and we should look to non-binary experiences and try to create something that's, you know, a little more inclusive, a little less tied up with patriarchy. Many of us can imagine that. Transmasculine lesbians do exist, transmasculine non-binary people do exist, but it's not something that there's a really broad awareness of outside the queer and trans community, or even in certain queer and trans spaces. And so I'm kind of using my poetry to talk about what that might look like on a broader scale. You know, in an anarchist society, how might we conceive of butchness and masculinity? Would we even have those labels? Would it matter? Would we even think about gender as a fixed or binary concept or something that has anything to do with the gender identity? If everyone was trans, would no one be? These are all the things that I think about instead of questioning my actual gender. And so trying to be the topics of my poetry collections. Because in a way, I think that the idea of gender assignment at birth is kind of antithetical to anarchism. You know, we really shouldn't be stereotyping people's bodies when they can't even think or consent when it comes to their gender yet. But at the same time, if we were to stop assigning people genders when they were born and everyone chose a gender identity based on what felt good to them, then we might no longer have trans labels or trans spaces or trans identities. And that would be a great loss to endure in and of itself, because for many of us, trans spaces are a lot of what give us meaning. And so that's something I'm kind of being speculative about in my work without really taking it into a futuristic place. Like, most of my poetry is very grounded in what does the anarchist movement look like today? What are we talking about? What are we doing? How could that change? But at the same time, these questions of trans futurity are very much in there. And the question of whether the construct of the future is even hospitable to queer and trans people at all. Like, much of my work has to do with atemporality and the fact that queer and trans folks often do not experience linear time in the same way the general population does, because the milestones of a typical straight life do not necessarily apply to all of us.
And I don't know, that question about like what exists without like its definition within the broader culture, like that. Those are interesting, like things I have thought about, like, and I've had this conversation fairly recently about, you know, though I identify as a woman and I use she, her pronouns and all of that, like there's been a lot of times in my life where I felt like I wasn't woman enough, or, you know, like I didn't actually fit our culture's definition of that. So what does that make me? And so I think this idea that somehow, you know, as someone, as a thinking person, as an artist or whatever, you know, there's really no way in our currently to define yourself without the context that we live in. You're either defining yourself, aligning with it, or figuring out how you differ from it. And so it's like you said, if this is a, if all of this went away, if everyone just got to pick their gender, you know, whenever they felt comfortable in their life to do that, what would that mean? And like, I think about that in terms of like social movements and political movements and all of that. Like, what happens when the thing that you've defined yourself against goes away? You know, like how does all of that work? And I think that is for me part of like reading Mitchell's book and part of reading other stuff right now is there is this, and like even within like kind of more occult or witchcraft spaces, it's like as it becomes more popular, or as it became more popular, I mean, I think there's a little pushback now because of what's going on in the overculture. But is it a cult when everybody's doing it and they talk about it online? You know, like what
Exactly.
does that mean? So
Like, I don't know how many non-binary listeners can relate, but in today's society, if I want to explain my gender to someone, it requires a paragraph. I have to say, I'm a lesbian, but I'm not a woman. I'm butch, and I'm trans masculine, but I'm not a man. And no, I don't want to pass. And no, I'm not going to be a binary trans man eventually. And no, I'm not going to be a cis woman eventually, but I'm non-binary and butch and trans masculine and lesbian. And if we were in, you know, an idealized anarchist society, I would just say, yeah, I'm a person who's butch and these are my pronouns. Like, having to define yourself in terms of binary gender heavily complicates things to the extent that it makes it really hard to define for people who don't already have an understanding of transness. Like, it's gotten to the point that if a toddler asks if I'm a boy or a girl, it's easier for me to tell them to guess than it is to explain. And you know, they do guess, and then it's really entertaining. One kid guessed that today I would be a boy, but then the next day I'd be a girl, and I felt seen.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I love when kids make clear that they'll grow up to either be trans or be one of those people who annoyingly guesses who's trans.
Yeah. Or just accepts that people are people. Hopefully.
Exactly. Too. Yeah. I mean, the act of guessing someone's gender is a little antithetical to that, but also he was three, so it was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Out of the mouth of babes.
But in any case, I tend to think about how many of us use the non-binary label, but that implies that the binary is something that exists and is real and should be responded to. Mm-hmm. And of course, I use the non-binary label. I'm not here telling people not to, but I find it interesting what we're choosing to focus on when we define our gender in terms of what power structures we do and don't engage with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting soup, and I think there's there's probably a lot to be said for living through things as they change and shift and define. And I just think, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, that, you know, language continues to evolve. Like, that's just how languages work. But it also, in these smaller ways, like terminology continues to evolve, and the way we think about ourselves and think about other people and, you know, our identities politically, socially, gender wise, whatever, like all of that continues to change and grow. And like, there's terms that Mitchell uses in the book, like the term in the title, that I feel very uncomfortable with and I would not use in conversation about anyone. And then there's, you know, but clearly, like, Larry Mitchell writing this book in 1979 was like, no, this is what I want to say. And kind of reclaim this word in this moment, even though I don't know that his reclamation stuck for everybody, obviously. But this is just this idea and how queer is used in that book versus how we use queer now. And, you know, there's a lot of people my age. I mean, I'm in my early 50s who are still deeply uncomfortable with using the word queer to describe themselves because it's what they got called in high school as a slur. You know, so I think it's interesting to me, like, to think about this both politically and as a writer, like, how, you know, I want to always not, like, be up on the terminology, but I want to be always respectful and I want to be always true to what someone would see in my work, you know, but I'm also, like, it's difficult to know how that will be perceived in, you know, 100 years, you know, 50 years from now. For reading this book and, you know, having this conversation about the terminology he uses. And then, you know, how do I think about that in context of my own work and my own identity and all of those things? It's an interesting thing to ponder, but can also kind of make you tired sometimes too. So.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I would consider myself pretty bold about slur reclamation in that I have a poem that involves me calling myself a dyke in like every line, and it did get published and I have read it aloud before, but at the same time there's a fundamental awkwardness to that. Mm-hmm. Like, I just know that even if someone in the audience is cis and they know that it's not for them, they still might feel a visceral discomfort. And in a way, I want people to have that kind of reaction to gay slurs if they're not someone who would be called a gay slur. I don't want saying slurs to be a low-friction experience for the straight people of the world.
Right, exactly.
But that's also always a consideration when they're being used. Like, for example, I have reclaimed the T-slur before in my life because I am transmasculine, but I probably wouldn't in a poem just because, you know, I mean, never say never, but I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
Just because I don't know that I'd feel comfortable shouting that aloud in a performance poetry setting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's like, you know, reclamation starts with a very uncomfortable place. Like, it starts from a very uncomfortable place. Yeah. Yeah.
And I know queer and trans people who would never say a slur of any kind.
Right.
And would feel awkward if they did so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know people who reclaim really different slurs. Like, I have a couple of friends who will not reclaim the T slur, but will call themselves a transsexual as a joke or not. And And you know, that feels positive for them. For me, that's really not something I feel comfortable ever reclaiming. Because it feels so tied up with the expectation that people medically transition, and that's not something that I personally like have a lot of desires around. And so I think that one is not something that everybody wants to reclaim. And you know, when I read this book for the first time, I really had to get over the shock of seeing the F slur on every page. But you know, once I had read it for the second or third time, it started to feel more like a neutral description that shouldn't have stigma attached to it. And that felt like exactly what the author was going for.
Well, and I think, you know, in the context of the book, this idea that, you know, I mean, he kind of sets up this past history where everyone was the same. All, I guess, like kind of in context of the book, all masculine people were the same, and then differentiated. They stopped touching each other. They stopped, you know, like, and then they became the men and the queers and the F-slur, you know, and this idea that these are different categories. And in the book, in the context of the book, for people who haven't read it, the queer men are men. It's basically, like you said, a critique of assimilation. They are gay men, but they are trying to be in the world of straight men. And like the violence and the disappointment that they are visited upon because of that shows up in the book in several different places.
Yes, exactly. And the point is being made that one can be masculine without engaging with maleness. Like they separate the men from everyone else, even though there are plenty of mask-identifying people, both gay men and both lesbians in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I was really trying to channel in a lot of my poetry. Like, you know, I consider myself masculine and center, but I hardly think at all about cis men when I'm thinking about what that looks like for me. And that's an experience that I think a lot of butch people and a lot of trans masculine people and, you know, a lot of lucky few who are both, myself included, can relate to.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, like, as someone who, you know, is married to a man and I've raised a son and they both identify as, you know, cisgendered men, but their, I guess, the word has slipped out of my brain. Their expression of their masculinity is like loving and kind and nurturative and, you know, not, to me, like, because I've been lucky to have so many men, people who identify as men in my life who are like that. Like, to me, like, that is always part of masculinity too. And I think this idea, like, this idea of the masculine being whatever Pete Hegseth thinks it is like actually kind of queer in like the old phrase queer, like in what queer actually means in the dictionary. Like, it's kind of weird that you can only be masculine or a man if you are this very narrow, weird, like, completely constructed thing. Like, that to me is so bizarre. So it's like, how did this idea of masculine in the overculture become this completely fragile, bizarre thing that can only, you know, it has to meet like a laundry list of things or it isn't real? I'm like, that to me seems like the most broken thing ever. So.
Like, I once was talking to a cis male friend about what it means to be mask of gender without having a problem with toxic masculinity, because, you know, he was working through this for his own reasons, having been, you know, stereotyped as mask as a kid and then ending up identifying that way. And I remember saying that, like, some people think that butch people try to act like cis men, but really, if cis men tried to act like butch people, we'd have a lot fewer problems. And I tend to really agree with that still. Not because everyone identifies with the historical butch role or with being culturally lesbian, but because butch masculinity is not about avoiding vulnerability. It's not about trying to seem tough all of the time. It's not about, you know, being disrespectful toward women. It's mostly about care and being a protector and a provider and being someone who is able to be, you know, the competent one and provide often manual or emotional labor and, you know, generally be a caring and loving member of community. Whereas a lot of cis masculinity is about expecting people to do emotional labor for you. Mm-hmm. And many cis men don't have that attitude, but the dominant culture does reward that.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think that's reflected so beautifully in the book. There's a couple sections, like I was specifically thinking about, the character's name has left me. But when the responsible one has his breakdown, why is the name falling out of my head? You'd think I would know these things. And then all of the other.
Yeah, so then people take care of him.
And people take care of him. Like the person who was the carer is then cared for until they are able to find themselves again. And just this idea that, you know, that's how we're supposed to work. That's how humans are supposed to work. We survive on the care of others, you know.
And that's exactly what butch femme dynamics are supposed to be about. Not mm-hmm. that every butch person is interested in dating femmes, obviously. Butch femme dynamics are a historical thing, not a blueprint for how people should behave. And, you know, butch for butch dynamics exist too. And, you know, anything is possible in queer spaces. However, I tend to think that the idea of both butch people and femme people providing care in different ways is so much healthier than how in a lot of heterosexual nuclear families, cis women are doing all the emotional care work and cis men are doing maybe more of like the practical types of care work. Mm-hmm. And really, everyone needs to be fluent in all kinds of care for a society to function, especially, you know, thinking about anarchism. Without the buffer of the state and capital, we would all need to be so much better at providing care and handling mental health struggles and handling conflict and being able to talk about these things without it being awkward and all the rest.
Yeah. No, it's true. Oh, I don't know. I feel like there's like so many layers to like looking at this book and looking at it in context of culture and all of that. But kind of before we wrap up, I wanted to just kind of ask you if there was anything about the book, particularly that we didn't cover that you might want to say before we kind of go into our wind down.
About my book or about Larry Mitchell's book?
About Larry Mitchell's book or about your book or in context of each other or however you want to do that.
One thing I loved about this book was its framing of queerness and transness as abundant and unruly, and how it connected that to a subversion of binary gender. Because many of the people talked about here were mask identifying in some capacity, whether they were gay men or butch lesbians or, you know, identified in some other way. But only those who had fully assimilated were referred to as men in the sense of a gender identity. So I think that that energy is something that we can carry over in our queer liberationist organizing today. The idea that no matter how you identify and no matter how you articulate your queerness and transness, queerness is a lot about building community and about networks of care and quite honestly implies anarchism in many ways. And if there's one thing I want people to take away from both this book and all of my poetry, it's that it is possible to dream toward anarchist futures, and we can do that by providing embodied, vulnerable care to one another, even if fascism makes that feel intimidating or weird, and by thinking past binary gender and learning to see masculinity in a way that doesn't have anything to do with patriarchy or cis male identity.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. And I think that I agree with you. I think that is a good takeaway. There are many. I would just recommend people read the book because I think it just has an interesting place in the conversation. And I think it's, you know, not just a historical text, but it is a living text and people should read it. And they should go read your poetry. So they can do that. Do you want to kind of tell folks where they can find your books or engage with your work?
So all of my work can be found at mkzariel.card.co, or I'm usually at mkzariel or at The Child and Its Enemies on the majority of social media platforms. And on there, you can find my three published books, my zines, my blog, my podcast, some info about my organizing work, and plenty of other stuff as well. The work I'd like to particularly highlight is, of course, my three published poetry collections. We talked the most today about wood gazing, But, you know, I have three of them out on Vinegar Press, Rockwood Press, and Whittle Micro Press. And I'm still looking to collaborate with people on getting the word out about those books. So if you are someone who maybe works with a bookstore or info shop or community center or punk venue, or if you run an archive or a books to prisoners project that would like a copy, or you enjoy reviewing books or whatever, please get in touch with me via my website or social media. I love collaborating with folks and building community.
Awesome. And I will put links to the card account and all that in the show notes too, so people can have that at their fingertips. But okay, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for reaching out. Like I always tell people, like, you know, a lot of the folks who come onto the show, I get sent by PR stuff or stuff, but I'm so excited when people reach out to me because they want to be on the show. So thank you for taking that opportunity and making this happen. So yeah, thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you so much for hosting me on this podcast. I'm really glad I could be here.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.